For showing up tonight. My name is Pablo Ogren, and I'm with the Public Works Department. And I want to introduce a few people up here who are going to be part of the presentation tonight. We anticipate that the presentation is going to take us about an hour, and that will get us to around 8 o'clock. And then the format tonight for questions and answers is that we have 3x5 cards, and John Waddell and Diana Haynes will take the cards, and if you want to write down questions on the cards, then that's going to be the most expedient way that we can get through as many questions as possible. And we're going to target that from around 8 to about 9 o'clock, or about an hour worth of question and answers as well. With me tonight in the middle is Lou Corella, and he is Corella Engineers' principal and lead on the project. Lydia Holmes and Lorian Fono also have been very helpful in the preparation of the project report. Carl Hadler out of their Seattle office, or whenever. Again, we have 3x5 cards to write those down, and then Diana and John Waddell will be picking up those cards. So tonight's discussion is about the viable project alternatives, fine screening analysis, and really this is our first step in developing community options under the county's efforts on your wastewater project. I want to talk real briefly. I'm going to do some introductions and then turn it over to the Corella team. But essentially, this report here is the first step in two essentially parallel paths. The top path there shows the efforts that will ultimately lead to project selection. The first step is that your technical advisory committee that's made up of several representatives of your community will be doing, and they are currently working on pro-con analysis. They have meetings that are about every week. They're going to take a break for the July 4th week, and they're walking through the report and doing pros and cons evaluations of the different options that are included in the report. Their meetings are open to the public, and your attendance at those meetings will certainly provide more opportunity to go into the details of the report than we'll have than in contrast tonight, which will be a bit more of a summary type of a format. The pro-con the report itself is broken into different components: the collection components, the treatment, the water resource management or the water reuse component, site selection, as well as the solids handling, solids disposal issues. And as I mentioned, this is really the first step in the engineering efforts. From here, the next step was going to be trying to define how to shape those different components into actual project options. And developing final project options will help a lot of people get better clarity as to what the ultimate outcomes might be for the community. But still, we need to take it, sort of one step at a time, do our homework from the county's perspective, especially. We haven't been intimately involved in Los Osos since about 1998 and had to renew our efforts, and it just takes time to go through this process. In developing those final project options, one of the things that we think is extremely as important is upfront defining what type of water resource benefits need to come out of the project, because, well, on the one hand, there's the septic discharges and the regional board's declarations that there needs to be a community wastewater system. On the other hand, there's very important issues associated with the water supply and seawater intrusion that's going on and the long-term sustainability of water supply. And so we think that in looking at these options and developing final project options, one of the first things that needs to be done is identifying the level of water supply benefits that will be an outcome. And so the Corella team will talk about the different levels of water supply benefits and different approaches for the water supply. Spencer Harris provided a presentation to the LOCSD Board of Directors a couple of weeks ago, and again was able to go into a little bit more detail than we will tonight. But in any case, developing those final project options needs to really provide a lot of consideration to the water resource aspects. After that step, and as you'll see, the concurrent path on the bottom has us working on the assessment engineering and the Proposition 218 vote. This engineering survey, a few months ago, we were calling that a community vote, And then we were corrected by our elections office that we're not allowed to call it a community vote under the election law, but instead it's got to be a community survey. And the intent there is that in 2008, we'll be sending out information to property owners as well as residents and business owners in order to find out what your preferred options are on the project, as well as more levels of details on overall community preferences, whether it's sustainability or preferences with energy or cost or lot impact. And then the due diligence box is what's identified in AB 2701. After the Prop 218 vote and before the Board of Supervisors makes a final decision on whether the county would implement a project, we have a due diligence process. And that due diligence process we think is really important. It gives us, at the county especially, sort of the opportunity to make sure that working with permitting agencies that the right conditions of permits can be established to really help make the project happen. Through that process overall, then, is the project selection. And one of the questions has come up, or an issue that has come up, is the idea that the Board of Supervisors has the final say on project selection. And I sort of just need to make the statement that that's the same here on this project as it is on all projects in California, whether it's a county or whether it's a city or a community services district. It's your elected officials who ultimately have the final say on a project selection. But the community survey and the CEQA process is extremely important so that the board has an understanding of what the community wants in terms of a wastewater project, all things considered, costs and environmental impacts, archaeology and everything. My hope is that individuals understand that that is one of the authorities that we rest in our governing boards. Under California Environmental Quality Act, that is ultimately comes out in the notice of determination. After the CEQA document is adopted, then the board will adopt a notice of determination, and that's essentially what is the direction to carry out a project. So concurrent again with those activities, we have assessment engineering, the Prop 218 vote. The assessments is just one part of the overall funding of the project. It's a component, the largest component of what would fund the capital costs. But of course, we also have operating costs, and we have the need to fund those also through normal service charges that are billed to customers. That's monthly or a bi-monthly basis. In some of the wastewater systems that we operate, those are put on the property tax bills as well. Those type of decisions, though, are really much further down the line. And then ultimately, with the funding and a project selection decision, we can move into design and construction. There's a really important point that I want to make here, because these project options right now are really based on cost estimates. And in this selection process, what we would like to do is to be able to develop a selection process that really gets private industry to compete. Our estimates have the positive value, I think, of showing that a step collection system is competitive with a gravity system or vice versa. They're both two viable project alternatives that are going to carry all the way through the process. And there is always a certain amount of debate that exists on cost estimates. We think that the best way of resolving that debate is to try to create a competitive contracting environment where things that we eliminated in the rough screening report should maybe be back on the table. And so that's part of the ongoing process of looking at issues and reevaluating what we've done. Certainly, we are open to the idea that someone identifies maybe a technology we've taken off the table and it needs to be put back on the table. That's part of the overall being responsive to your community. The next box shows that May is when we released the draft fine screening analysis, and it will lead to the 218. But the last box says that the engineering studies are one component of the county's overall project efforts. And I hope individuals had the opportunity to go out into the courtyard. The posters that are set up in here were really focused in on this report that we're talking about tonight. But in the courtyard, there is a number of posters and county staff talking about the other related efforts that we're working on, whether it's the grant efforts or the Prop 218 ballot process. And again, the emphasis here is this is one part of the overall project efforts that we're working on. What it relates to, though, is that it does provide us the good first initial step in a framework for discussing community options, the benefits, and the costs associated with them. But the report does not provide specific project recommendations. One of the things that I was really pleased to see last night at the TAC meeting was the dialogue started to change a little bit from this technical report and the different components like treatment and collection into what are we going to do in order to start actually shaping the options. And the reason that that pleased me is because it is definitely the county's intent to find out what the community wants. What we don't want to do is we don't want to come out here and say, okay, we know what's good for you and this is what, you know, you need to think about. And so the dialogue and what's going on, I think it's very fruitful, and it is starting to turn into the direction of what are good options for the community. But again, this doesn't have those type of recommendations. That's part of the process, is taking these technologies, working, you know, essentially, again, this is some of our homework, and then seeing where we're going to go in terms of project options. Kind of touched on this, a community-driven decision-making process. Even though the Board of Supervisors, like governing boards throughout the state of California, have to make those type of difficult decisions, it is still a community-driven decision-making process. Participatory government is very important. Understanding community preferences, both through the public input, at meetings, at the Board of Supervisors meetings, the postings to our website that we've had, as well as the survey that will be done in 2008, understanding those community preferences are part of participatory government. And, of course, I think everybody knows that this project has plenty of challenges associated with it. There are numerous legal challenges. There have been in the past. We kind of got to anticipate that there's going to be legal challenges in the future as well. There is some issues of litigation that are going on right now, and overall, it's just part of the framework of developing projects. And then, of course, there's regulatory and other requirements as well. And I think it just really bears repeating that when we're working on complex projects like this, there are a lot of different constraints that start shaping how we can go down the path. So on the one hand, participatory government and community-driven decision-making, his opinion, we're still going down the right path, and we've gotten positive feedback with him, we're glad to say. The State Water Board discussions, one of the things that we made sure to consciously include in this report that we think is really important is that under a step alternative, we have heard from State Water Board staff that if a state SRF loan was utilized for the project, and it's certainly worthy of considering since it's a low interest rate loan, it's a discounted loan program, that's not conclusive that we're saying that we're going to use it, but we want to try to figure out what's the cheapest money that we can borrow. But what they gave us in feedback is that an SRF requirement would include on a step system having separate wiring and separate meters for every step connection off of every lot. And that's above and beyond state electrical code requirements. And in order to challenge them back on that particular issue, and we think that it's a worthy challenge, we thought that those cost estimates really needed to be defined in here. And so we hired Toma Electric to do that. And that's part of this report then, is identifying some of the challenges that we see from a regulatory standpoint, not the ones that are necessarily based on standards but are more of the gray area, and being able to then develop the documentation so that we can get into the negotiations there if again, that source of funding is utilized on the project. And then lastly, the bullet point number 6, again, I wanted to touch on groundwater management. Already identified that is one of the critical issues associated with developing project options. It's also happens to be one of the areas of litigation as a result of the groundwater adjudication that's going on right now. And adjudication is just the attorney's name for groundwater litigation. But we also are very hopeful that we can develop cooperative arrangements with the water purveyors in order to help resolve the overall resource issue here in Los Osos. And with that, I think I'm turning it over to Lou.
The engineering evaluation of the options for this project were truly a team effort, and along with the Carollo team, I too want to recognize the contributions of Cleith and Associates and Rob Miller and others that have really brought some of the best ideas for this project forward. So it's been quite a team effort. Pablo touched on a couple of the issues that with regard to what the fine screening considered, and the fact that we continue to use the NWRI report as kind of a guidance report for us. But the previous efforts from the county's design in 1998 and the district's lead project and also the Ripley report, those are all reports and previous efforts that we've given considerable paid considerable attention to as we've tried to develop our own options for the latest efforts here. Things change in communities. Regulatory conditions change. Community preferences change. Other things change. And we wanted to be sure that for whatever options we brought forward to the community, that there was some consideration for this future adaptability. The evaluation of options began with the understanding of the interdependency of the project components. And what we mean by that is that there are, in general, the five components associated with the project: the collection system, the treatment plant, the treatment site, the reuse and disposal options, and the biosolids alternatives. And they all, in some way or another, touch each other. Some are more dependent on one another than others, but in this graphic that was also included in the draft fine screening report, you see it starts with the understanding of the measurement of the benefit of the project, in addition to addressing the WDRs, would be a look at seawater intrusion mitigation. And that then led to the look or discussions of reuse and disposal alternatives, and those then, of course, touch on treatment plant sites and treatment plant technologies. And treatment plant technologies are also affected by the collection system alternatives and so on. So there is an interdependency of the individual components as we move forward and figuring out how to put them all together. It's also very important to understand how they relate to one another. With regard to the collection, treatment, and disposal interrelationships, it was important to understand that disposal and reuse dictates the water quality requirements, which would then dictate the treatment requirements. And that has to do with this tying to this here. And the collection system impacts influent parameters and treatment performances. And what we mean by that is that it's recognized that there is a difference in effluent quality that or influent quality that comes from either a step system or a gravity collection system, and we show the connection to the treatment technology there. It's also important to understand that in the interrelationship of these components, that nitrification and denitrification will be required or may be required to meet low nitrogen levels for some disposal options. It's also noted that filtration is required to meet reuse requirements according to Title 22 requirements. So the fine screening report resulted, as Pablo said, in draft findings of community options, community option benefits, and community option costs. I'm going to get into, for the next couple minutes, Lydia and I will talk about the community options of alternatives. The community options provide the basis for the pro-con analysis. The team had a conscious effort in identifying the goal of where we needed to be to be sure that there was more than one path to getting there. And so that's why, we continue to leave options open for the collection system, the treatment, we believe, and then, of course, the on-lot impacts of both the step system and the gravity system. But our focus, because there's so much information out there already on the gravity system, our focus has been to fairly evaluate all the step system benefits and cost. A few of the items that the issues that we addressed in looking at step were the reduced solids loadings from the septic tanks. We gave credits to the step in looking at our plant sizing. There is less sludge disposal required. We considered on-lot costs, including electrical, for both step and gravity. And just to go back, to remind you that the on-lot costs for the Tri-W project stopped at the property line. And so to be fair to both options, we looked at the on-lot costs for both step and gravity all the way to the house so that we included the on-lot costs. We also considered road restoration costs, which we felt was something that was a little under-addressed in the previous efforts, but are real costs to the project. One of the conclusions that we came to is that while the costs that we show on our boards up here are higher than the costs that you've seen for a step system from the Ripley report, there are some reasons for that. But basically, as we look at the unit cost and the base project costs that Ripley identified, we found that the costs were generally fairly similar. Well, and I guess I'll just mention that the difference in costs have to do with the electrical costs. It has to do with the cost for odor control, which was, we're not sure if it was addressed or not. We couldn't find it in their report. It had to do with road restoration, and it had to do with the level of contingency that was provided for the feasible level study. The findings for the collection system for step and gravity were that both step and gravity sewers will be carried forward as community options. We think it's, again, important to leave, provide that flexibility, and in the end, maybe let the industry break the tie in terms of what is the least cost alternative and best application for the community. Alternative contracting methods can demonstrate which option is less costly. That's what I was just referring to, creating a situation that allows the industry to weigh in heavily on the option. But of course, the community preference will be an important part of that decision. We want to move on to treatment options, and I'll have Lydia come speak to these.
Okay, so the next component that we looked at was the treatment facilities. And selection of treatment requires consideration of several things, including waste discharge requirements. The regional board had issued several past waste discharge requirements, so we looked at those to see what kind of level of treatment they'd be requiring. Compatibility with the disposal options, as Lou mentioned, what you choose for your reuse and disposal options will set what your level of treatment is going to be required. And that may be more than what the waste and nitrification, denitrification for nitrogen removal. And we do want to note that the Tri-W project MBRs, the biomembrane reactor, is still on the table, and that is a tertiary treatment, level of treatment with nitrogen removal. So it's a little bit above and beyond the base levels of treatment that we're discussing here. So I'm going to talk briefly about each of the different types of treatment that we've included here. So facultative ponds, the area requirement is 15 to 20 acres. And despite what people might have heard about Corollo maybe building only concrete facilities, actually in our past we've built plenty of pond plants, and personally I really like ponds. I think they do a lot of things for you with low energy. It avoids having to process solids every day. The solids tend to drop out in the ponds. You have to do just more occasional management of the solids instead of daily. So there's a lot of good things that ponds do. But in California, regulations have continued to get more stringent, and so a lot of agencies have moved away from ponds because ponds are subject to Mother Nature and so tend to have more variable effluent. The water quality is not always consistent. So it's a little more difficult to have a consistent effluent quality for filtration, for your pretreatment for filtration, and it's also difficult to have reliable nitrogen removal. For this application, we have provided additional nitrogen removal by add-on processes. Okay. So the next process is an oxidation ditch. This is an activated sludge extended aeration process, if you're familiar with those terms. It is a more mechanical, concrete-based type of secondary treatment, and some of your neighbors have these, if you're familiar with California Men's Colony and Pismo Beach, they both have oxidation ditches. And because it's a more mechanical process, it's a less acreage requirement. BioLac is our third treatment type, and it is actually a very similar type of treatment to oxidation ditch. It is also an activated sludge extended aeration process. The difference between oxditch and BioLac is that BioLac tends to be, instead of in a concrete tank, it's in a earthen basin that's lined with a membrane. So that requires a little bit more land, which is why you see it's a 10-acre requirement instead of 8 acres. But it's a similar type of process, and it also can produce, as with oxidation ditch, good nitrogen removal and is a good pretreatment option for filtration if you have to go to that step of treatment. So don't want to forget the biomembrane reactor. And as we mentioned, that still is on the table. And biomembrane reactors are also actually an activated sludge process. It has, however, a membrane filter after it, which is a very tight filter that basically blocks all solids. So you end up having very high-quality water coming out of these. But those certainly do come at a cost for both energy, and the membranes are expensive as well. Central Valley area as well. And the bottom one is an aerated pond. So these are certainly treatment processes that are used in nearby communities, and it's nothing unusual about any of these treatment processes. Okay, so of course, as part of considering treatment, we have to consider where to site it. In the rough screening report, we started with 18 different sites. There were in-town, edge-of-town, and out-of-town sites. And we ended up with 3 high-priority sites that are being carried forward in this report, as shown here. Just to give a little bit of discussion about the rough screening, I mean, basically, in town, there's very few locations that are big enough, so the only one that was carried forward was the Tri-W site. The edge-of-town areas tend to have more endangered species issues, and so it ended up that really considering, you know, things like the acreage available, topography, geology, visual impacts, environmental impacts, these ended up being our top priority sites. Okay. So moving on to our third component is biosolids. So out of your treatment process, you have solids that then have to be managed and disposed of or reused. So considerations for the solids options include affordability versus the long-term regulatory climate, flexibility for future upgrades, and regional solutions. So I'm sure you've heard that there are counties out there that are banning biosolids application, and so that's what we mean by long-term regulatory climate, that things are changing, you have to be aware of that, and you want to be flexible so that in the future you can add on additional processes if you need and do something different, because one thing for sure is it's going to change. And regional solutions is, it's still on the table to potentially have a regional septage facility at Los Osos, and that would be further evaluated by the county in the CEQA Plus process and the due diligence during that period of time. All right, so there are 6 different solids options that were considered. And they're laid out here by a description of Class B, Class A. That is a description that's set by EPA, and it basically defines a level of quality for the solids. And then there's also treatment processes. So there's subclass B, there's digested Class B, heat-dried, composted Class A and B, and then digested. Really what we get down to is that the solids treatment and disposal is a community-driven issue. The subclass B hauling is the least expensive, and it does leave you the option of adding on additional processes in the future. But there may be reasons why you want to go to a higher level of treatment. So that's why we say it's community-driven. There's community preferences. Although you see the second bullet here is that value engineering. Certainly, if you choose to add on more in the value engineering type of process, if you were getting SRF funding, they have to look at, you know, the costs. They would say that's not necessary. Treatment plants have a bit of a different configuration of their treatment than what is proposed for yours, but just to note. So these have chosen to go to a higher level of treatment than what we were talking about. All right, so the last component we want to talk about is effluent disposal and reuse. So there's several issues affecting effluent and reuse disposal, effluent disposal reuse options. The first and foremost is the disposal capacity. You have to have enough capacity to get rid of all the water. And frankly, this is one area where some past projects, I think, have not done a very good job. We want to have, you know, for the full amount of flow, enough capacity, and you want to be, and you have to have that capacity available all year round, because you can't count on ag reuse in the winter when it's raining. So you have to have wintertime places to take the water as well as summertime places to take the water. Of course, another important issue for Los Osos is the groundwater management issue. The septic discharges are an important issue to consider, and the seawater intrusion that's occurring is of course, very important because that's, you know, disrupting your water supply. And, in fact, it's such an important issue, and Lou alluded to this before, that all of our effluent disposal and reuse options are measured by their ability to mitigate seawater intrusion. But the wastewater project can only partially solve that problem. It cannot solve the whole problem on its own. So a combination of options is required for capacity and seawater intrusion mitigation. And this is what I was talking about, is that we want to make sure we have enough places to take the water. So we have to combine lots of different options so that the different times of year you have places to take the water. Down in the left corner, you'll see there's a little box that says, you know, conservation is a common component, and this is important. We wanted to bring up that we're assuming for every project option that you would do a toilet retrofit program that would help you do some of the mitigation for seawater intrusion. We also included spray fields for every option. The spray fields provide a good flexibility to take the water someplace. And in that is also storage. Again, for wintertime, you need to have storage to go with the spray fields. And ag reuse, you'll see, is in each one of these also. However, it's difficult to predict how long it would take to implement ag reuse. So under each of the different levels of seawater intrusion that we've had, we have options of with and without agricultural reuse so that you can start on that level and then add in ag reuse as you're able to get agreements with the users. Broderson, I want to also mention, the Broderson site is included as an option for reuse and disposal. It is not in every option. However, to get to the highest level of seawater intrusion mitigation, without getting the water purveyor's support, you'd have to use Broderson to be able to maximize that. And Broderson provides you the nice benefit of being able to have a place, again, to put it on that for level one, you have a seawater intrusion mitigation between 90 and 140 acre feet. Level two is 190 to 240. Level three is 550 to 590. Lou will be talking about this in just a minute as we get into more details about the benefits of the project.
Well, Lydia, one of the things we want to mention is that in those different levels, there is a project identified for level three without Broderson.
Yes. Right. So finally, water company participation is needed for the greatest benefit, which I was alluding to before. And as Lou was saying, if the water purveyors participate, you can get to a high level of mitigation without Broderson. Okay. So So moving forward, some of the important things that we're going to consider are the other sources of disposal reuse information that we've drawn on in the past and we'll continue to look at is what the regulatory requirements are going to be, the previous waste discharge requirements, and what are other communities faced with in terms of regulatory requirements. The Cleath and Associates groundwater report and the groundwater modeling has played a very important role in being able to help us define how much seawater intrusion mitigation each alternative provides. We've looked at and will continue to use as a model Scotts Valley, which is in the Santa Cruz Mountains. They've successfully been able to arrange a financial cooperation with the water agency to help pay for the elements that are for water supply benefit. And final, local water purveyors' participation is important, and they may also have their own ideas about some other options of how to use the effluent for reuse and disposal or to do seawater intrusion mitigation. Okay, so as a closing, before I hand it back to Lou, you have all these different elements: collection, treatment, biosolids, and reuse. And so the community options basically all put together provide a basis for the pro-con analysis moving forward. And Lou's going to talk about the benefits that each of those options provide.
Yeah. I wanted to talk for a couple minutes about the approach for identifying the project benefits. And it's kind of an interesting exercise that we went through because as you start the process, we say, well, we need a project to address the WDR, but also we've told the community that we're going to come to them with a benefit cost analysis that helps them make a decision as to what the most appropriate alternative or option for their community is. So the question quickly became, how do we measure the benefit? And as Lydia said, we talked about that being measured by not only and first and foremost fundamentally addressing the WDR, but then addressing the groundwater management concern of seawater intrusion. So community options benefits were measured by seawater intrusion mitigation. And currently the seawater intrusion issue is occurring at 460 acre feet per year. And the replacement of the septic systems will increase seawater intrusion, it's been estimated, by about another 90 acre feet a year. You'll see, I'll discuss that in some further slides. But in the end, the community, we need to understand from the community the desired levels of mitigation with current conditions as a minimum. And that is why we've tried to identify different levels for your consideration. And then reuse and disposal options offer different mitigation factors, and I'll talk about that in a minute as well. So the four or five levels, actually, that the project team considered were levels 0 through 4, and just walking through these quickly, level 0 said that the project only answered the WDR but had no mitigation of seawater intrusion. We didn't consider that a viable project alternative. Level 1 met the minimum goal of do not worsen the existing groundwater condition and mitigation of seawater intrusion similar to the current conditions. Level 2 was the maximum mitigation of seawater intrusion possible without purveyor participation. And level 3, which significantly then jumped up the mitigation response, would be an achievement of a balanced basin at present water uses and rates, and this would require purveyor participation. And level 4, which is only introduced but not discussed in the fine screening report, is achievement of a balanced basin at build out, which also requires significant purveyor participation. So we wanted to talk a little bit. I alluded to the fact that different options have different mitigation factors. And I wanted to, this is a very cool graphic that Cleath and Associates, Spencer, developed. And I don't know if you showed this the other night, Spencer, or not. So the communities maybe have seen this before. But on the downside here, this is the bay. Here's the Morro Bay Estuary. This is east of town. and this is the this represents the Broderson area. And in general, I'm going to run through this because there is something that Spencer has continued to remind the team of, and that is the closer you get to the seawater intrusion barrier or the barrier, the higher the mitigation factor might be. So as you stand east of town, it's they're lower, but as you come closer to town and to the bay, the mitigation factors become greater. And what we show here is that actually the spray fields, without any other sort of component to it, a component that might involve some sort of exchange of wells and the purveyors reconfiguring their pumping, has a zero mitigation factor because it's outside the basin. But as you come closer to the bay, the ag reuse has a mitigation factor of 0.1. Broderson was identified to have a factor of 0.22, and reduced west side pumping, which is the best we can do, would have a mitigation factor of 0.55. So there's a couple of points to be made here. One, reduced pumping, a number of different factors. We have a lot of information. We have a large database ourselves, but there was a lot of construction bid information already out there on the project. We also looked at analogous projects. We used our own unit cost factors. There were previous bid tabs were available and previous estimates. And capital costs, the costs that are presented in the report, were escalated to an estimated midpoint of construction of June 2011. And what's important about that is that it, in the end, and it seems like a blink of an eye, but that will, to the midpoint of construction versus the last bid that we received by the community in 2005, represents a six-year escalation of costs. The vision was, the goal was to provide cost estimates for each level of seawater intrusion mitigation. And as we set out, we said, well, of course we can provide higher levels of mitigation. However, it's not free. For each higher level of mitigation you go to, there's a cost. And so, the point being, at where is the balance for this community? But what we found and what we show here is, I should go back and explain this graph. So what we show here is on the left side we have cost, and along the bottom axis we show the different levels of mitigation, and we schematically identified these costs going up. But as we moved forward into the cost estimates, we found that a couple of things, and let me explain what the graph here is. Again, here are costs in millions of dollars, and here are the three levels of mitigation. And the blue numbers represent for a gravity system, and the red numbers represent for a step system. And we separated those out because, as you know, the collection system is the largest single component of the project and represents about 65%, two-thirds of the overall construction cost of the project. Well, what we found is that when we compared the different levels of mitigation, that there was actually considerable overlap. And what we show here is that the top of the colored lines is the minimum part of the range, and the top of the gray lines is the upper part of that range. And so you could see that in any one of these cases, the higher end of one, or the lower end of one alternative might be lower than the higher end of the previous alternative. And so what essentially this told us is that while we had predicted a nice scooping line, it turned out to be a little flatter than we thought, and the alternatives a little more comparable in cost. The other important thing we did was compared this to the Tri-W project costs, and you can see that all of the alternatives identified were less than the previous Tri-W project costs, but also there's an alternative here that, where note that the mitigation factor for the improvement is about 240 acre feet a year for the Tri-W project, which would have put it in this band, And so we'd be comparing these costs for mitigation improvements versus what was predated, which means that there is an advantage to considering higher levels of mitigation, a cost component to that. If we put the mitigation measures or mitigation benefits on a scaled graph, so these, again, are the project costs, but here we actually scale to where they can be compared. You can see that for a similar, I mean, there's a differential cost, but it's around 12%. For a small differential, you can get a significant improvement in the seawater mitigation benefits. And on top of that, if you look at this differential, which is somewhere $20-25 million on a just under $200 million average project, what brings you out to here is really the purveyor participation. And so the project itself, the wastewater project, would follow this line in general, and the purveyor participation would provide these benefits and these costs. And I think I'm ready to hand that over to Pablo.
Thanks, Lou. Just a couple more slides before we wrap up the presentation portion of it. And this slide is, why is the project so expensive? And, you know, I think that it's kind of obvious there's a lot of work to be done. There's a lot of different components. It's not just a treatment plant. It's not just replacing some lines in the street. It's the whole system. In today's regulatory environment, and the fact that on construction projects we have to pay prevailing wages, that's an issue that is important to consider in California, especially if we're comparing it to cost estimates on projects in other states. But one of the things that I think really needs to be emphasized on this particular slide is the different percentages of the different facilities. For example, down at the bottom, the treatment site and the biosolids issues tend to be a very small component of the overall costs. And when we turn our attention in the coming months to selection processes, what it indicates to us is that when we look at the different costs, how do we walk through the decision-making process? For example, as Lou was mentioning, Lydia was mentioning on biosolids, the Class B hauling is certainly, in our evaluation, the least costly method of approach. On the other hand, if the community wants to do composting or wants to do some other enhanced methods of biosolids treatment, it's probably not going to be a big significant difference in the overall project costs, and that is a good thing for the community then to decide upon, is what level of biosolids treatment, how do you want to handle biosolids. It's also important, as they mentioned, that when we're in the CEQA process looking at regional sludge handling, certainly in San Luis Obispo County, we have challenges with regional sludge. Is there ability to do perhaps composting in the community, doing a regional sludge handling, solids handling, bring in revenues from other portions of the community, and maybe get enhanced solids handling at no additional cost to the county? But that is essentially... It's in one respect a standalone issue, it's good, but in terms of the actual cost of it, not a significant portion of the cost. When it comes to disposal reuse, the idea that the water purveyors, we very much would like to have cooperation and consider participation from the water purveyors. Scotts Valley is one example in the state of California where water purveyors have been participating with the wastewater entities. In Scotts Valley, essentially, the water purveyors upgraded the wastewater treatment plant from a secondary to a higher level of treatment so that then the reuse project could be implemented. Again, it was at a wastewater facility, but the water purveyors paid for those costs. And I think that's an important issue in Los Osos because the prohibition zone itself is not the entirety of the community, that the prohibition zone and those who might be paying for the wastewater costs are a smaller portion of the population. And when we turn to the water supply benefits, it is very arguable that the entire community should help pay for the water supply benefits. It is, in this example, it's approximately a 17% factor on the overall project costs. But when it comes to decision-making, working with the water purveyors then is going to be very important. The treatment costs themselves, treatment plant, 15%, pretty close to disposal reuse. And what some of our thoughts here is on final project selection with respect to the collection system, since the collection system is clearly the most expensive cost associated with the project. If in going through the selection process, we can nail down the treatment site, we can nail down disposal reuse and treatment plants, then we might be able to set up a model where we get private industry to give us hard and fast contractual commitments for the collection system, and being able to do that so that we can get a step system to compete with a gravity system and see where it is, bottom line, that private industry is willing to make its commitments. Because the cost bars that Lou showed a little while ago, there is some overlap, and the cost estimates themselves are at such a preliminary stage that they have plus and minuses of plus 30% or minus 15%. But the estimates themselves are such wide ranges that really, if we can get the treatment site, disposal reuse, the treatment technology and the biosolid stuff nailed down and then let private industry compete on the collection system, the most expensive component of the collection system, then that's the type of a selection model that we want to be developing in the coming months and pursuing, because, again, the vast majority of money that we spend is money that is spent on private industry to deliver a project, and the sooner we can get private industry to make hard and fast commitments on these project costs, the better that we're going to know how to approach ultimate decision-making processes. It's complicated because we have to do it concurrent with CEQA evaluations and the current regulatory environment that we're working with, but nevertheless, we think that there is definite potential in being able to get private industry to get into a competitive mode there. The other point I want to make on this particular graphic is that if you look at the different chapters of the actual report and on these different components that are around the circle, you'll see the construction cost estimates. It's really in Chapter 7 where those are brought together with total construction costs and then the inflation factors to 2000 that I want to make it very clear, though, that that's the direction that we at the county gave to Corollo. That was not Corollo's decision. What we directed them to do is to first and foremost focus in on what other community options could be developed. And let's get that out for the community to review as soon as possible. Certainly there's volumes of information in prior engineering reports and revenue models on information associated with the Tri-W project. And that is very much part of the Technical Advisory Committee's pro-con, is to compare these options to the Tri-W project. And so we've been working with the Technical Advisory Committee. We weren't sure whether the Technical Advisory Committee wanted to look at that other information that had been prepared on Tri-W and independent of us, bring it into the pro-con analysis, or whether they wanted us to summarize the information on the Tri-W report. As it turns out, we are pulling that information out, summarizing it, and providing it to the Technical Advisory Committee. But the point of emphasis here is that in the final report that is produced by Corollo, that comparative information to the Tri-W project will be included in that final report. That's part of our ongoing efforts with the Technical Advisory Committee and with the community moving forward. Also in the chart, it shows that the assessment engineering deadline is fast approaching. It's July 17th that we've scheduled time with the Board of Supervisors on how to approach the assessment engineering, developed lots versus undeveloped lots, the wastewater types of benefits versus water supply benefits. And that, as I had mentioned at the very beginning of the presentation, was an important portion of this assessment, of this engineering evaluation, is that the level of detail helps to start guiding us on decision makings for project, but it also helps break down the costs so that when we can develop equitable cost sharing arrangements between developed and undeveloped, between those who would be connected to the wastewater system on the wastewater costs versus the community as a whole on the water supply costs. Again, July 17th is the date that we anticipate being in front of the board for some policy decisions on how to approach the 218 vote. And then in 2008, it's going to continue to be refining the project options and leading to a community advisory vote. Of course, we want your input so it can be incorporated into the final report. Some of the next steps include the 218 ballot this fall. In 2008 is when we intend to initiate environmental compliance and permitting. I spoke earlier about the due diligence, and that is the period of time between the 218 vote and when the board would make a final decision on whether to implement a project, and that's our period of time where we could push back to the permitting agency for reasonable permit conditions. 2008 is also an important period of time for peer review. Dr. T from UC Davis has indicated that he would very much like to participate in the peer review in 2008. Community advisory vote, we called it a vote here. It's really supposed to be called a survey again, summer of 2008. There's still a lot of work that needs to be done. And the long-term schedule, we made sure to put draft on here because that's just one of the disclaimers associated with the Los Osos wastewater project. That's always important. But overall, we look at 2000, putting it in that perspective, maybe it's not too unreasonable. But it does emphasize there is still obviously a lot of work to be done. And one of our goals, again, is to try to set up a process so we can be objective, impartial in looking at the different options. We recognize that the controversies exist. We have to just walk through it step by step. I think this is a really good first step, obviously. There's some moss on every step as we go along. It's going to be a slippery road. And then one of the questions I got here on this line called, not quite there, assessment collection period that could start as early as the tax roll in fall of the December 10, 2008 property tax bills. So this particular line on the schedule shows 2009, but essentially that's the property tax bill that would be due December 10th, 2008. But it would not be for the full amount, since we would just be in the early project efforts. Those assessments that could not begin sooner than, again, December 10, 2008, would slowly start to ramp up so that then by the time that construction is complete, then they would be the full amount of the assessments and the full amount of the service charges. And that's sort of the last statement that I'm going to make is that now that the engineering estimates are in this draft report, we, our accountants are now able to start working on what are the estimates associated with what the monthly household impacts are going to be. So that we do not yet have. We anticipate that the first draft of how it's going to affect household impacts on a monthly basis will be around the end of July. It's Ken Cardoza, who was set up out in the courtyard, is the CPA on our staff, and he's developed a 30-year life cycle cost model, and we're going to be developing those estimates of the monthly impact on essentially years 1 through 5, 6 through 10, 11 through 15, 16 to 20, and then years 20 to 30. And they're going to be developed under different options so that some real bottom line comparisons can be provided as to the fiscal impacts on everybody in the community. And with that, I'm going to ask Spencer Harris and Mark Hutchinson to come up so that we can start doing some of the questions and answers. And I saw a number of individuals were writing out cards, and that took us a little bit more than an hour, and so we're going to play it a little bit by ear, but... Just so that we're trying to keep reasonably close on schedule.
Maybe I'll sort through your problem.
It appears that we have a whole lot of questions, so we're going to get through as many as we possibly can. I can't guarantee we're going to be able to get to all of them, but what we will do with all of the questions is we're going to get them into a document file, and then we're going to make sure to get answers to all of the questions so that we can get them posted to the website and also provide them to the Technical Advisory Committee for part of their review. So I got the first one that we have is, what does it mean for water purveyors to participate? And I guess the participation side from the water purveyors is sort of multiple. One idea is in the decision-making process itself. The water purveyors are the ones who are providing you with your potable drinking water supply. And it's very important to work with them on water resource issues that are feasible for them to deliver water to you. So one level of participation is just simply in the decision-making process. In about the mid-1990s, I helped draft the original groundwater management agreement between what was then County Service Area Number 9 that preceded the LOCSD, Golden State Water, or it used to be called Cal Cities and S&T Mutual. And so there has been, for over 10 years now, a framework for a cooperative decision-making efforts, and we want to further that in terms of our efforts on a wastewater project. Other forms of participation include just simply financial participation. We do think that the options should be on the table for the water companies to financially participate in this project because, again, to the extent that the water supply benefits are community-wide benefits and the water purveyors are providing service to a much larger area than or a larger area than what the wastewater service would be provided to, that financial participation would be a way of spreading some of the costs to the community as a whole and developing the most equitable methods of cost allocation as possible. And certainly that is sort of the model that was established on the Scotts Valley example that we provided.
Pavel, what I'm trying to do is sort these into some categories and get at the ones that I think the most people would be interested in. There are a number of them that are fairly specific technical ones that I'll sort out for the team to work on. But here, too, that sort of go together, at what point will affordability guidelines be factored into the payment schedules? And will we know the sewer bill for the whole project before a 218 vote, or will more costs come for the water side later, and how will we know?
And the House of Representatives is considering their appropriation bill this week. I guess it was last week and moving into this week in order to get Los Osos actual federal money. We've got a number of different grant efforts that are ongoing, and that will help address affordability. The grants we're pursuing in two forms, the federal money, which is the Water Resource Development Act, and even though the Bush administration has been opposed to any new WERDA authorizations, there's a big change in Washington, D.C., both from which party is in control, as well as Hurricane Katrina and the impacts in New Orleans, and more of a focus for domestic spending as opposed to international spending. And the dynamics do seem to exist that a Water Resource Development Act bill can get through with real money this year. And so we're cautiously optimistic. That money would help reduce the overall cost of a project. Our hope is that that would help pay for the actual treatment facility. The other types of grants that we're pursuing are the grants that can actually be targeted specifically to low-income or disadvantaged individuals who live in the community. The integrated regional water management grants that Courtney Howard is helping to pursue and that Supervisor Gibson and I spoke to the State Water Resources Control Board in February and then again in March. Those are monies that we would like to be able to target to the low-income individuals. And the USDA, Department of Agriculture, and some of their grant agreements, John Diodati, who was with us earlier today, used to be working for USDA, so he knows their grant models. And what they have is that if a property owner gets a grant and then within a certain period of time, like 5 to 7 years or so, happens to sell their property and move out, and you know, we know that there's a fair amount of equity in Los Osos, even though cash flow on paying for a project is a whole different story, more challenging. But if a property owner gets a grant and then they sell their property, the idea is, can we get reimbursement of the grant so it can go back into the pool and then help with the next group of individuals for financial assistance? And that's something that is currently structured in USDA models. And so that's an approach to affordability. Getting grants, though, is going to be very crucial. The other side, though, is that how the rates and charges are structured for a wastewater project. Because we know on the assessment side, in assessment engineering, pretty much says that they have to treat all single-family residences the same, whether there's five people in it and it's a large house or whether there's one person in it and it's a small house. And that's because the assessment engineering is statutory under the California laws. It's much more restricted, and it's saying, hey, this wastewater service is provided to the property, and if it's a single-family property, then it's a property is a property. But when the board's policy-making decision on rates and charges can go to more of what is a demand-based rates and charge. So the households that only have one occupant and have very little water, indoor water usage can get the lower charges, and those who have the higher demand would have the higher charges. And that's what part of Ken Cardoza is starting to model right now. But that demand-based rate structure is what the city of San Luis Obispo, for example, is just implementing this year. And so those are the two basic approaches to, you know, addressing affordability. One is through pursuing grants, and then the other one is through the financial tools in determining what.
It's a joke on me. Just, I know we've answered this before, but there are at least three cards here that have to do with the timing, the participation, the weighting of the 218 vote in terms of which will come first, the Prop 218 vote or the final project options. You know, will there be an amount given? Will out-of-town property owner votes be weighed in the 218 vote? Just general participation in how the 218 process works.
Okay, so that's also Bruce's hint for me that it sounds like he's getting ready to ask me more questions so I can speed up the response to the responses.
You're doing fine.
On the 218 vote itself and the timing versus project selection, the idea is the 218 is really going to need to happen this fall, and that is the decision of whether the community wants the county to implement a community wastewater project. And if the vote is yes, then we move into the environmental review, final project selection, and all of the details. If no, then under AB 2701, the project authority reverts back to the Los Osos Community Services District. The weighting of the actual vote, it's a property owner vote, and it's in proportion to the proposed assessment. So single-family residences will all have the same assessment proposed, so they'll essentially have the same vote. But, for example, multifamily and commercial properties will have different assessment amounts. And the easiest way that I really think of the rule is you get one vote for every dollar of proposed assessment. And so if your property happens to be, if you have a commercial piece of property or you have a multifamily and you have a twice as high proposed assessment, then you have twice as many votes. That issue again is that's the one that I talked to is going to be the July 17th board direction, but we're not we don't anticipate any assessments proposed for out of town, and so therefore out of town property owners do not participate in the Prop 218 vote.
And then we have a number of questions asking for some clarification on the Tri-W site. Is the permit still valid? If it is ultimately selected, will the environmental work and permitting start from scratch, or will we be using the permit and environmental work already in place? And if you know, this is let me just ask the question as it was written. If the Tri-W were not already on the table and you were proposing various systems and sites, would that have been considered?
Okay, Mark Hutchinson is going to take the lead on the answer. Again, Mark is our environmental division manager. He's the individual who's primarily responsible in our department for all of the permits that we obtain for on environmental issues. I'm just going to real quickly on Assembly Bill 2701. What that, it is our position, allowed us to do is that it allowed us to step into the shoes of existing permits under that language. But that only really related to the
with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency as the responsible federal agency on that. We follow these quite closely. All of those permits are currently valid. However, coastal permit is in the CSD's name. So if TriW was to go forward, the county could, if that's the project the community selected, the county would have to approach the Coastal Commission and request that they transfer that permit, and that would be a decision of the Coastal Commission under the authority of AB 2701, whether they do or don't transfer the permit. As far as the EIR, the CEQA process as it's known, the short answer about EIRs is they're good as long as they're still good. Meaning if it still addresses all of the pertinent environmental issues, then it's still good. Except that if the county were the lead agency or the agency to do the project, they would become what CEQA calls the lead agency, and that agency is required to adopt what's called CEQA findings. They're legal findings of fact regarding the project, all of its impacts, and all of its mitigation. So it doesn't matter if the EIR is good or not good. If you assume that it's good and the county was to step into that role, the Board of Supervisors would have to have a public hearing, would have to develop findings of fact for all of the environmental impacts that that document discloses. And the board would have to explain why they find something significant, why the mitigation is good enough. Ultimately, perhaps, they would have to explain why they would do a project in spite of significant unavoidable environmental impacts. So there would be work to do there. As far as the endangered species permits goes, those animals are under the purview of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. It's not likely that they would change their opinion, but the lead federal agency could change. Environmental Protection Agency is in that role. You haven't heard about them before. They're linked to the state revolving fund loan. They have a small link way back there. If we didn't get an SRF loan and say we use Water Resources Development Act funding, then the Army Corps of Engineers, of all people, would step into the lead federal agency role, and they would go to Fish and Wildlife Service, probably get those permits reissued under their purview. So the permits are there. They're valid for the agency that got them. There would have to be changes made, adjustments across the board if the county were to step into the lead agency role.
Concerns with the location of TriW in a ravine directly above a national estuary and how that's handled in the environmental work previous or current. I guess the question there is, in terms of the permit, how are concerns about environmental issues such as the location of a plant relative to sensitive resources handled? And would we be going back to scratch, I suppose, is the essence of this question.
Well, the important thing, the foundation that we have to work from is that CEQA is based on physical impacts on the ground. So if the situation on the ground is the same as it was, even though a new regulation comes in, you may not have a requirement to go back and manage to do their engineering and their permitting and their fail-safe methods to a degree that it satisfies the regulatory agencies. Certainly it's a challenge. Anywhere in Los Osos drains to the bay ultimately, but it doesn't seem to be an insurmountable challenge at this point.
And the next question really, again, just finishing up on TriW here, was the value that was estimated for the TriW. How was the cost of the TriW project? The two questions are really... one had to do with Broderson, actually. If Broderson can only accommodate 10% of the disposal into the lower aquifer, what value does that particular site have? You know, what value does this $11 million site hold? And the other question, are you factoring into alternative projects the $26 million already invested in Tri-W?
I can answer the cost estimating question, which how was the Tri-W cost estimate handled? And that was handled by taking, starting with the bid tabs from the 2005 construction start, and escalating those costs to 2011 to be sure that we were comparing apples and apples with the other alternatives, and adding such things as on-lot costs, because remember, for the to be fair with a comparison of the STEP system, STEP has on-lot cost. We added not similar on, they were directed to the gravity system. We added those costs to the estimate, and that's how we handled the Tri-W costs.
I'll pick up the second part of the question, which is relating to the $26 million that had been previously expended for the Tri-W project. And there was actually more historical expenses than the $26 million. Prior to 1999, the county had expended about $6 million on the project as well. That during the transfer over to the LSCSD, the County Board of Supervisors just kind of, that was water under the bridge, if you will. But neither that $5, $6 million or the $26 million incorporated into our cost estimates, because really, while it's very regrettable that, you know, the turn of events has occurred in Los Osos, we really have to pick it up for where it is today, and we have to look forward. And that can be a very difficult issue in any type of issue that we're, you know, dealing with in life. But the idea is the past is the past. We have to look at it, prospectively. What is it the cost is going to be in the future? And that's what these cost estimates are really focused on.
And the next set of questions you may have answered while I was sorting here, but one of them is, will you use several rough bids to estimate the real current costs of both STEP and conventional collection? And let me just sort of lump all these together, which involve cost estimating. How do the total costs for a homeowner differ for gravity and STEP? Project expense, installation, possible replacement of a septic tank. Do you have the details on the specific on-lot costs between different potential collection systems? And a little about Orenco build, and if proposal by Orenco will be considered, how will that work? Also bid design build. So if that hasn't confused you completely, I apologize.
But I can be easily confused. That's why I need lots of people to help on this project. The letting private industry weigh in is more than just weigh in. It's actually giving contractual commitments on what we would have to pay them to implement project components. There's a number of different mechanisms under statutes in California, some of them which are currently available to us, some of them which aren't. Our ideal would to be able to do design build, and we would lay out a competitive environment so that the contractors and the designers of a gravity system could just simply go head on head competitively with the contractors and the designers of a STEP system. When I had that why is it so expensive chart up on the board, the idea is that we think we could, you know, the treatment sites themselves are not the large component of the cost. We think we could get certain work done, identify a treatment technology, and then say, okay, what is the cost of that treatment technology if we have STEP inflows to it versus the cost if we have gravity inflows to it? And set up a selection model under a design build where we then get private industry designers and contractors for a gravity system to compete head on head with those for a STEP system. So that the issues of cost estimates as we are right now, those issues of estimates and how good of estimators we are, kind of go away, and we have firm contractual commitments from industry on what they're willing, what it's going to cost us for them to deliver. Now, that ideal design build authority is something that we do not have in the statutory provisions today in California. And as I understand it in Sacramento, there's a bit of a battle between Republicans and Democrats on how that type of authority may or may not get established. So then we have to go to a plan B. And a plan B might be, okay, since the gravity system has already been substantially designed, maybe what we can do is to set up a step through a design build, because we do under code section 5956, and that's sort of the Orenco option, that is, we believe, statutorily available to us, and set up that design bid process so that Orenco can compete on that. And since the gravity collection is already designed, then just get real bids in on the gravity side, because, again, we don't necessarily have. Now, that plan B we don't like as much because it doesn't have the exact, you know, it isn't quite an apples-to-apples contracting environment, and so it's a little bit more complicated. The third option is to, since we have basically a gravity design, is to design a step system and then have those who would construct a step system bid head-on-head with those who would construct a gravity system. So there's a number of different approaches. We'd love to get the legislative authority that would allow us to go simply with the design build all the way through. But short of that, we think that there's a plan B and a plan C that might work. Again, it's how soon and what ways can we get
tanks in each lot, and then quantifying that, tracking it, and there's actually a pretty good graphic in the back of the room there that shows the percentages of lots that have septic tanks in the back, in the front, in a tight location, and so on. The goal for this project was to, for the step systems, work under the assumption that all the step tanks would be replaced in the community. And secondly, that those tanks that are not in the front of houses or accessible to the county's maintenance crews would be moved to the front of the homes, hopefully in a driveway or something, you know, agreeable to the resident, and make it easy for access and maintenance of the county's crews. So then we also, for the, that's so for the step, and then we applied cost for all of those. For the gravity system, we looked at the connection to the house based on the information that Diana identified, and again came up with construction costs of a lateral, moving the lateral from either the back of the house or wherever it was located to the curb. And that way, in the end, we were sure that we were being fair to both alternatives in the total cost associated with the work on the resident site.
And I just want to make a real quick comment, is that we understand that, you know, cost is a huge factor on this project, but cost isn't the only factor also. You know, there is construction impacts of one type of a system versus another. There's on-lot impacts of one system versus another. There's a number of archaeological impacts are different. There's a number of issues that are non-cost issues that also will need to come into the decision-making process.
Let me just follow up with just a little bit more on cost, and then we'll shift here. Questioner noted that the Tri-W project didn't receive a lot of competitive bids and was asking about the sense of the competitive outlook at this point.
You know, that's an extremely important point. At that particular point in time in 2005, the Tri-W project was not the only project around that was just getting single bids. The industry, we were getting projects at the county that were only getting single bidders on it. Now, and the reason I say that is because, you know, it wasn't just because Los Osos can be a challenging community. It wasn't just because of the Tri-W project. Part of that influence is, in fact, because the industry was very, very busy at that point in time. It continues to be busy with some of the state propositions that were approved last fall, the 1A, 1B, the different grant funding that was approved. We anticipate that it's going to continue to be a busy environment for contractors who do public projects. That's the why, like for tomorrow afternoon, We're going to be meeting on the phone with Orenco and talking to them. That's part of what we at the county have to do to reach out to the contracting industry to build those type of relationships so that they want to bid on the project so that we can create a more competitive environment. An understanding of what the bid is, and you're putting all the burden on them. Well, you know, we're going to lose out for the other agency, Monterey County or Sonoma County or whomever, who's reaching out to the contractors to explain what the job is. And so in order to make sure that it's a competitive bidding environment, we really have to start that now, and we have to start it with some of the relationships that the CSD had previously established. And that's just part of enhancing. We know it's going to be a busy contracting environment, and that's part of our job of reaching out to the contractors and encouraging that competition.
And a related construction management question. Questioner references some road work on Santa Isabel, which went over budget. Actually, the budget was exhausted with, let's say, about half of the originally planned improvements in place, and it took 4 to 5 times as long as anticipated. Ended up different than what was planned. What will the county do to make sure this won't happen on the wastewater plant?
Well, it's interesting. You know, sometimes even the smallest of the jobs can be extremely challenging. I'm not actually familiar with that project other than I know that it didn't go all that great.
That's a fair summation, and I can fill you in tomorrow if you have a couple hours.
Okay.
It basically got caught in cost escalations and delays in getting it up on the list of things to do. Well,
you know that there are a number of sort of project management strategies that we have to really focus in on. Some of the smaller projects can be challenging because in the department we have a number of project managers. And so, for example, we have a project manager who might manage multiple projects. When it comes to the larger projects, we dedicate staff exclusively to the single project. So like John Waddell and Diana Haynes are dedicated exclusively to the Los Osos Wastewater Project. And that's one mechanism of how do we utilize staff within the department in order to keep a project moving on track. The idea is don't have that staff have to work on multiple projects. Keep them dedicated to this particular project. That's one project management strategy. Another, though, is the idea of timing. When projects, large or small, get hurt by escalation, it's because of time delays. And that's why the process that we've set up, we intentionally look at doing concurrent activities. It's one of the reasons why we believe the Prop 218 needs to be pushed forward as opposed to delayed. We want to, right now, this engineer's report, as I previously explained, we're going to be going down parallel paths. It's taking us down a project selection path, and concurrently it's taking us down the funding path. And the more that we can do parallel or concurrent work activities, the quicker we can deliver a project and minimize project escalation. You know, again, on cost escalation, reaching out to the contractors and trying to get them to be competitive on it. Those are a few of the project management strategies that we have to be diligent in on this particular project. And I apologize to the community on the Santa Isabel project.
A couple of ones with potentially short answers. Will the public be able to see Dr. Chabanaglos's feet? Has the regional board indicated it will accept StepSteg in light of the fact that it's rejected that technology twice?
I'm not sure about the rejection of the technology twice or if anybody can help me with that particular one. Our meetings with staff have indicated that, yes, obviously, we have not formally been in front of the regional board with the request. Supervisor Gibson and I will be at their July meeting, providing them with an update, making it very clear that STEP is on the table. We don't really anticipate a problem from a permitting standpoint on STEP for a couple of reasons. One is primarily they're responsible for what comes out of the wastewater treatment plant and meeting the WDRs, the waste discharge requirements. They also, especially in Southern California, will have permit requirements on collection systems. But that's not a pass or a fail. The issue is what would their conditions be for a step system. And what they've generally indicated to us is that those step tanks and that pumping system that's in the tank would have to be a publicly maintained, that if we implement a step system, then the county has to be responsible for the maintenance. They won't accept private property responsibility for the maintenance. That makes sense. It's also why, as Lou mentioned, we would need to have all those step tanks in the front yard, because we really don't want to have to send, you know, maintenance workers into somebody's backyard, and I'm not sure that very many property owners would want us to do that as well.
Okay. Back to water purveyors. There's a lot of talk about water purveyor cooperation. What is the process to ensure that this happens?
Well, I think that the details of that process really gets to kick off now that we've got some engineering analysis that we've worked in. We've actually sort of been in it slowly through that adjudication, the litigation efforts that are going on, which can't really talk about because it's litigation, and I get slapped by attorneys if I start talking about that stuff too much. But even that, I would just characterize it as that was slow moving until we were able to come up with our analysis. And so now that that's done, we're going to be able to pick up our discussions with the water purveyors and look at, you know, what's the best approach to water management in the district.
Okay, and another, are the water purveyors obligated to go to level three? And by that, I assume the level three, the level of benefit three. And what agency actually has legal influence to make this happen?
No. You know, before about a little bit more than a year ago and getting back involved in the community of Los Osos and turning attention to wastewater efforts, I had spent the better part of 10 years working on water resource issues, from implementation of projects and working on contract negotiations with Nacimiento and looking at groundwater management adjudications that was involved in the Santa Maria. And the idea of influences on water can come from every single angle possible. That's why, you know, the water wars exist. Whether it's policy issues or trying to do something on a discretionary or a cooperative basis, which is always the preferable method, whether it's the adjudication or the litigation route, which tends to be when the attorneys get involved, a little bit more of a fisticuff. Under California state law, there's also the authority to do groundwater management ordinances, and those aren't very common, but they're similar to land use and zoning powers that the courts have affirmed. Those are the two models that are strong in California for getting water resources back into balance. And again, there's push and pull involved in that. But I'm cautiously encouraged that, you know, the community is going to work together to pursue what's right.
A couple of specific ones. Maybe I'll slip this one. There it is. What's the basic cost difference monetarily between a level one and a level two degree of benefit? And maybe implied in that is, what's the, should we go to another question while you get to that? And maybe it might be good to also review what the difference in benefit is there. There's another one, a more specific one about what's the saltwater intrusion mitigation? I would take that to be, what's the benefit to the saltwater intrusion problem of pumping what's outflowing from the upper aquifer and either treating it to drinking water standards or using it for high nitrate irrigation water?
Spencer?
Use of the upper aquifer water allows you to offset lower aquifer production. So you do gain a significant benefit by doing that. As far as the percentage goes, it's approximately a 45% mitigation benefit. So because you're actually pumping water out of the upper aquifer, similar to when you collect from the septic systems, there's a little less pressure to drive upper aquifer water into the lower aquifer for recharge. But then by offsetting your lower aquifer production, then you gain that back, and then plus your mitigation for reduced lower aquifer production. So the benefit's about 0.45.
Okay. And Diana thinks that since Spencer's warmed up, we ought to ask him this one. What level of interest is there from farmers for using treated water for irrigation? And is the county proactive on this?
I think that's probably more of a Pavo question than a Spencer question.
All right. Fair enough.
The issue of being proactive, I think, is first understanding the situation, and certainly I think we're proactive in understanding it. The idea of implementing, what is a timetable of really feasibly implementing a sort of a long-term ag exchange program? And realistically, those take a long time. That we believe that in the short term, that's why we talked about whether it's spray fields or even short-term use of Broderson, that there is options where under level three, Broderson doesn't need to be used, but it might be very likely that Broderson needs to be used in the short term. Ag exchange, if it is going to happen, is going to take a long time. And that just simply makes sense because agriculture, that's their business. They're going to walk into it slowly. We have to expect for them to walk into it slowly. Also, as we know, just within the last 12 months, you know, the spinach issue up in Monterey County, and we know that that wasn't a result of use of treated wastewater effluent. It was more of, I guess, some animals and livestock sort of getting loose. But still, there is a great concern, and there's a lot of perceptions, and those perceptions are very powerful, that when it's the application of treated effluent, especially on food crops, that is a very slow process. Now, we think that the idea of ag exchange can be a very beneficial water resource strategy in the community. We have to be realistic, understanding concerns of ag and understanding that they're going to want to walk into that very slowly. I think that the CSD and Dana Ripley had done a good job of some initial contacts. But again, I don't want to get any expectations outside of reality. We have to think that what might happen there has to be a slow-moving process. And so I guess maybe being realistic is being proactive.
I have an answer on the cost estimate difference between the different levels. And the basically, between level one and level two, and just to remind you, level one is a mitigation of anywhere between 90 and 140 acre feet a year, and level two is 190 to 240, so about, in rough terms, twice the benefit. The costs are actually very, very close, in the range of $140 to $180 million total project costs. Okay? When you go out to level three, and that's the big leap in mitigation benefit to 550 to 590 acre feet a year, the costs jump up about $20 to $25 million. And remember, in the graphic that we showed in the presentation, most of that additional cost would be attributed to purveyor projects that to provide that additional benefit by some sort of revised pumping strategy.
And as we've crossed 9 o'clock here, I'm going to suggest we take two more. One of them has to do with energy, and one of them I think is fitting because it's sort of the end product, has to do with biosolids. So one of the questions on this card, shouldn't the lowest energy project be the highest ranked one?
I think energy is certainly an important consideration. It's not the only consideration. And there's an important thing to remember. I mean, in terms of energy and sustainability, and I'll speak in a second on the type of analysis that we're working on now that Ken Cardoza, the CPA, is doing. But energy and how it fits into, like, the sustainability and having lowest energy costs in the long term, when we look at sustainability, there can be things within that context itself that can compete with each other. Those types of treatment processes that could provide the highest water quality effluent coming out of the plant itself will be very sustainable, very beneficial for the water cycle, but they can also create the higher energy costs, and so they might not be the highest ranking. For what is highest ranking for sustainability on the water cycle might not be highest ranking for sustainability on the energy cycle. And that's where, even on the sustainability issue, again, we can get things that are sort of competing with each other. So in terms of the lowest energy costs, project. When we look at energy sustainability, yeah, that should be the highest ranking for energy sustainability, but that doesn't mean that it's necessarily going to be the highest ranking for water quality sustainability. Both of those are important issues, and that's part of the pro-con analysis. It's part of what your technical advisory committee is working on, is weighing those things. The other thing that we're doing on energy, though, is also in the financial cost model, or the sensitivity analysis, what if energy costs go up at double the rate of inflation? How would that impact everybody's monthly bills? That helps to set energy in terms of cost, not the sustainability issue, but cost in a context of total project cost, and to run sensitivity, because we should expect that energy can run higher than the rate of inflation over time.
And the final set of questions, I'll try to group together as a request for a bit more detail, perhaps, on the handling of the biosolids. A question about whether the 80% moisture hauling, I presume that's a classification of sludge, is actually the cheapest permits that are required, and some of the details in the requirements of when it can be spread. And another card is asking about the health impacts of the plant operation and trucking septage and sludge as regards various regulatory agencies like OSHA or possibly the Center for Disease Control. Let me put it this way, does the fine screening report get into what level of detail does the fine screening report get into regarding the health issues and the detailed permit and disposal issues of the biosolids? And how often does sludge have to be removed?
The fine screening report does not address the OSHA issues, the public health issues related to septage hauling or biosolids, actually. So it doesn't address those issues. I'm trying to remember all the other questions.
Well, you know, we're down to a fairly detailed level of question here that I think will be appropriate to go to the, you know, to the team for the specific analysis. But the question was, in terms of thinking about the cost of dealing with the solids handling, what level of details have been considered? Have the health issues, have the frequency of trucking issues, have what, you know, just what goes into your determination of those costs?
So included in the costs for biosolids alternatives or options is the trucking cost to haul it to a certain location and the tipping fees that you have to pay to dispose of it. So that is included in the cost estimate. As far as public health is concerned, I was alluding to that earlier in the presentation. The EPA has standards set up for that they, you know, Class B, Class A, that's their standards for quality of sludge, and they have very specific requirements for how you can dispose of solids that meet those different requirements. You know, what can be land applied and what are the restrictions for how soon after you do a land application you can put water on the site so that you limit any water running off that might carry pathogens. So there's a lot of regulations set up for that.
Okay.
Just to add to that, with regard to biosolids, I wanted to make the point that of all the project components, the biosolids is clearly the most, the least dependent on the other project components. So when we say in the presentation that how biosolids will be handled in this project by this community, it is truly an issue of being community driven, value engineered, you know, the cost estimates, you know, considered and making a decision, because it really doesn't affect the other parts of the process.
Lou and Lydia, just to sort of follow up, Lydia, you mentioned tipping fees. And is it fair to say that when solids or sludge are transported out to another facility, that when we pay the tipping fees to that particular facility, then essentially what we're paying for is them to become responsible for the ultimate disposition of it? And like maybe the like at the Bakersfield composting facility, then what they do is they would run it through composting for the
ultimate. That's right. Just because the lowest cost option that we've presented is a subclass B hauling, that doesn't mean that you couldn't have a contract with a private composting facility, you would pay them similarly a tipping fee based on weight, how much you're taking to them, and they would then process it to a higher level of treatment.
Before I yield the floor back to Paavo, let me thank the project team as a whole, the members of Public Works, many of whom are here, Diana, for helping me sort these questions, other members of Public Works who are scattered throughout the audience, Carollo and Spencer, members of the TAC, many of whom are here as well tonight. I'm constantly impressed at the level of detail and the thoroughness of what you've been doing. I would add to the audience that we continue to look forward to your input, both in venues such as this through the website and through my office hours, however you wish to get it to you. Appreciate also the time and interest. I may have stepped on everything Paavo was going to say, but I want to express my my gratitude for those of you who have stayed through a very long evening and absorbed a tremendous amount of detail. Your interest for this project is impressive, and I was thinking as we got started here, the base level at which we start here in terms of technical knowledge, in terms of what's step and what's conventional, and that is truly impressive. So, thank you all for coming.
I'll just wrap it up real quick again. Thank you all. It was recently explained to me that the TAC meetings really do need to be on television, and they are going to be. This last one was televised, and the future ones are going to be televised. Again, the technical advisory committees are a great forum for input, the website, and just so that you understand, I continue to meet with members of your CSD board of directors and a number of individuals in the community who are very active in these deliberations, and we look forward to continuing to work on this project for you. Thank you again.